Hello and welcome to another news episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital currencies and helps you understand how both digital money and assets will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Jonas Groß and today it is time for another news episode. We look back to the month of November. Again, a lot of key news that have taken place. And we will discuss particular institutional blockchain and digital currencies. Today, I'm joined by my co-host, Manuel. Hi, Manuel.
Hello.
And with us today is for the first time, Atakan Kavuklu. Atakan is a project manager at AllUnity, I think now very well-known stablecoin issuer in Europe. But maybe, Atakan, you briefly want to introduce yourself to our listeners.
Yes, thanks, Jonas. Hello, everyone. Very happy to be here. As Jonas said, project manager at AllUnity. I've been in the space for about 5 years now. Actually, a very long time listener of this podcast. When I started here, I used to listen a lot to this podcast. So very much looking forward to today.
Good to have you.
Yeah, it's really a pleasure. And we have, as always, a fully packed episode today. And we will cover in particular three key topics. One is tokenized deposit news. A lot has been going on here, in particular, JP Morgan is hitting the gas. Then, as every month, I think since May, stablecoins. We do have another stablecoin roundup with, again, I think very exciting news once more. And last but not least, we do talk again about the digital euro, because also here we do see movements both from the side from the European Central Bank and also finally the legislative process in Brussels, where we will comment and evaluate the recent developments. But first, let's have a look how the total crypto market developed in the past month. And this is until today when we record November 27th. And it has been a hard month for the market. It was not going up in November, as this is often the case, statistically at least. And at the end of the month, we had roughly 15% minus for the whole crypto market, resulting in a current market capitalization of $3.3 trillion. I guess the key trend was really a massive sell-off of risk on assets such as Bitcoin and others as well due to some macroeconomic factors and trends. And here the crypto market was also impacted and I guess higher impacted than other asset classes. But we have also in the last couple of days seen a slight rebound. What I found very interesting is that, I mean, often you can look into a lot of indices and do some analysis on, you know, when the market will go up again, down again, whatever, which we typically do not do. But what I found very interesting was that the so-called fear and greed index, which measures kind of the sentiment in the crypto space and lies between 0 and 100, was around 7. And this was one of the lowest levels ever. So there was absolute panic, absolute fear, because under 20 is extreme fear. Now it's back again at 18, but still fear. But it was really, really a low and one of the lowest it has ever seen, which I found very, very interesting and really showed the sentiment very well.
What I found quite interesting is that in some Bitcoin-focused podcasts, they were now again already talking about the next cycle, which is now a bear market. I mean, I don't pay attention too much to the price signals, but this industry still seems to be going up and down, and people are directly jumping on the new narrative, whether or not this is a bear market. Let's see what happens. I mean, as you say, we don't follow too much the ups and downs, but agreed, this was a quite strong and massive sell-off. Quite impressive.
So when we look at Bitcoin specifically, there was also a decrease of around 15% from $908,000 to $91,000 US dollars with a low of $82,000. So you've seen here the rebound I talked about. But I think despite this rather negative total market development and trends, there were a lot of positive, surprising news, I would say. And for me, by far the most interesting news was that the Czech Central Bank basically invested in Bitcoin. It's a 1 million investment portfolio. So, you know, not a crazy amount, but still. And they see this as some kind of a test portfolio of digital assets based on blockchain. So the purpose of the portfolio was not now to build up a Bitcoin reserve, for the next decades, but more to gain practical experience with holding digital assets, how to implement this, how to store the keys, how to do the custody. And I want to, in particular, show one quote, which I would like to read out, because that was for me kind of very bullish when I read this. And it says, the analysis shows that digital assets are evolving and being incorporated into the investment assets of funds and corporations, and that they may gain increasing acceptance in the future. The Czech National Bank intends to be prepared for these changes. At the same time, however, it emphasizes that it's not planning to include Bitcoin or any digital assets in its international reserves in the near future. So the typical disclaimer in the end, but the first two sentences from a central bank are super, super, super bullish from my side. And this is why, yeah, I really want to dedicate also the attention to this analysis and the findings of this analysis.
So for them, seems to be, if I understand you correctly, more technology preparation to be able to for potential future. You also say they want to become ready to hold Bitcoin, US dollar, stablecoins, tokenized deposits. So really to become technically enabled. Is that your interpretation?
Exactly. So it's about technical enablement, but also they do see this further trend that these, you know, this the assets class has been coming up and that companies, you know, whatever, invest here. So they do see the trends and want to be ready for the trend. That's how I interpret it.
I think it shows that specifically the US dollar stablecoins and tokenized deposits is a clear signal that it's a technical decision. For US dollar stablecoins, I assume they want to understand how to hold ERC-20 tokens. And with tokenized deposits, it's probably about permission systems, holding tokens on permission systems. So quite interesting also to see from a technological perspective.
And I guess for a central bank with their legacy system, it's also not so straightforward, you know, to store private keys, how to, you know, do the on-ramp, the off-ramp. So I think it's really good that people try it out because we often criticize that people are not practical enough in this space, but just talk about things that they didn't try out. Here they seem it's a different approach. And for me, this was like a very, very important development and milestone, if you will, because at least from my understanding, it's really the first central bank that invests into Bitcoin, even if it's a small amount. And I just zooming out, see again this interesting trend. So if we look 10 years back, it was only a few people invest in Bitcoin. Then maybe 5 years back, it was only a few companies. Then maybe 3 years back, it was only a few states. And now it's only a few central banks. So you see this narrative and whoever invests, this changed massively. And people that still think that Bitcoin will disappear, I think they are on the wrong side of this.
That makes me feel bullish again. Thanks, Jonas.
But no investment advice as always. Typical disclaimer. Another interesting news for me was just to see which kind of players also invest into Bitcoin, that actually the well-known Harvard University tripled their Bitcoin holdings. So they have a fund where they invest in all kind of assets. So Bitcoin is now a very important part of this. It's actually via IBIT, so the ETF by BlackRock. And it's even overtaking Microsoft and Amazon just from a you know, investment perspective, which I found very interesting and yeah, also noteworthy to mention.
The largest disclosed position of Harvard is now a Bitcoin ETF. Let that sink in, yeah?
Yes. And isn't that crazy that we start with so many positive news in this month that from a price perspective was not so good? But yeah, looking maybe at one like a negative news or negative like discussions in the end that happened, of course, this month around these, let's say, Bitcoin reserve companies, also like MicroStrategy, right? Because what you see is if the price is going down, we know that these companies struggle because often the main or the key theme is to invest in Bitcoin HODL and maybe partly sell. So this means if the Bitcoin price goes down, these Bitcoin strategic reserve companies also go down a lot. And this was particularly the case for MicroStrategy this month. So also actually minus 15% since July. And I mean, they hold 3% of all Bitcoins, right? So it's 650K. And again, the discussion came up, what, you know, happens if at some point in the future, the price gets so low that MicroStrategy, I'm always saying Microsoft, but it's a strategy and MicroStrategy, that they will sell their Bitcoin, which could heavily impact the market, right? So there were a lot of doom scenarios also sketched, but I guess it's a legitimate threat and thing to think about what this would mean to the market. Good, briefly into Ethereum, just to round this up, similar month as Bitcoin, so minus 20% beginning of the month, 2,800 at the end, 3,800 and now 3,000. So yeah, also not the best month, but yeah, let's see what December then will bring as a Christmas present to the crypto market.
Yeah, and then let's go from all the market signals on crypto more on also some market updates. We don't do this usually, that we simply drop some pieces, but we couldn't put those pieces into other buckets, which we want to focus on. So stablecoins, tokenized deposits, and the retail CBDC in Europe, the digital euro. So we decided to also bring those up, given that they are quite significant. One of the news that I quickly want to bring up is that Clearstream now launches the D7 tokenized securities platform. And I mean, clearly Clearstream is, to all of your listeners, is likely known, but it's one of the Europe's largest post-trade and custody provider, ultimately. So it's from Deutsche Börse, from the Deutsche Börse Group. And they have been working, and it's already live, on a D7 platform, which is not blockchain-based, but ultimately allows non-paper-based, so fully digital security issuance for quite some time already, for quite some years. As a reminder, the Electronic Securities Act in Germany allows, since it was released, I think, also like 3 or 4 years ago, and the issuance of digital securities in two forms, either as digitally recorded on traditional databases, but also in tokenized form, meaning issued as a token on a blockchain. And Clearstream so far has only been playing in the non-blockchain world, so to say. They've been experimenting, of course, over the last years, especially also last year, when they participated in the trials and the pilot of the ECB to settle capital market transactions and central bank money. But they haven't had an offering, and that has changed now. So they now released this D7 DLT plan, which will be built over the next years. And quite exciting, because this is now one of the largest CSDs in the world, offering really a tokenized security platform for issuance and trading. And that then complements the existing D7 digital issuance solution. So it's not about a replacement, but rather a complement. The investors can now really choose between digital but traditional format, or also DLT native issuances via the existing integrations that these players already have into Clearstream, right? So this is also a big benefit. You don't necessarily have to connect via different ways, but can use your existing integration. And they focus on commercial papers and medium-term notes, which then also benefit from this intraday issuance. So we know this, for example, in the US, where commercial papers can already be issued on an intraday basis, even non-blockchain based. So this is quite an efficient market. In Europe, this market is not as big. And they now want to also make use of the new technology and the new issuance platform for issuing commercial papers. So quite interesting. And I think a bold move to now really double down on this new infrastructure, and clearly also, you know, participate in the next evolution of central bank money integration, as they are also part of Pontus and Appia, that can then also be used on this platform.
Maybe to add here, Manuel, I think what's also interesting, and which is also fresh off the press, yesterday we had the news of AllUnity and the Deutsche Börse's collaboration. So if there's any interest in having the whole end-to-end lifecycle on DLT already live today, Deutsche Börse can also leverage stablecoins such as Eurao from AllUnity.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I was about to also mention that, but you will, I think, also come back to that. But we can pick it up already, Atakan. A question that I would have: Clearstream has announced over the last weeks a couple of partnerships, right? So they started, I think, with Circle. Then SocGen stablecoin was also integrated. Now also AllUnity. They built their platform, however, on a private permissioned Hyperledger BESU blockchain, right? So it's not a public blockchain. How are you aware, or can you talk about it, how that integration will then work? Is this a bridge between the two blockchains, or will there be an AllUnity on the BESU blockchain of Clearstream?
It's still work in progress, so there's not much I can say. However, we as AllUnity try to be, or are, blockchain agnostic. So it would be a stablecoin on Hyperledger BESU in that case. But again, it's a work in progress, so the details are still being crystallized here.
Definitely a bold move that we see, so curious to see how it develops. Clearstream has issued, and we've covered this when it came out, I think it came out maybe 2 years ago or so, they've also had their crypto trading platform. I haven't seen so much traction. I think now with the hype of around tokenized securities, that could change. but we'll definitely follow closely. Maybe we can get Thilo from Clearstream in the podcast as well to talk about this move. Now, a second update that I wanted to bring with is Swiat receiving a BaFin license for a crypto securities register. We've had Swiat a couple of times in the podcast already. Ivica Aracic, for example, is quite vocal and quite known in the German industry here. So it's a Frankfurt-based fintech specialized in blockchain software and tokenization. And there is now received a license for the Crypto Wertpapier Registerführer, the longest German word. So it's basically a registrar for issuing crypto securities under Germany's electronic securities law. So again, coming back, this is required. If you want to issue a tokenized security, you need to have this registrar. And yeah, Swiat now has received that license. That's great. Congratulations to that. And Swiat has been making notes, and we've been covering that also on unbundling, so to say, their blockchain infrastructure from the services that Swiat wants to offer. And this is now the, the regulated layer one, that's what it's called, right? Yeah. Regulated layer one, where also co-investors came in to build basically a pan-European or even global blockchain infrastructure, still private permissioned, right? Where securities can be issued, where collateral can be issued, and really in mind for TradFi use, so to say. So traditional finance entering the blockchain era, where then Swiat can provide its services on. And here then, again, also issuing or offering the registrar services for crypto securities. Yeah, so quite interesting as well. And then last but not least, a quite interesting announcement news. What announcement is actually also correct, because the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, BCBS, they want to reopen the capital rules for crypto holdings discussion. So as you, dear listeners, eventually know, and I'm quite sure you are aware, in 2022, this committee has basically given guidance to all global regulators for new regulations that global regulators should adopt for capital requirements and capital treatments for banks that hold crypto assets on their balance sheet. And this was really a clear, the industry interpreted it that way, but I think that's fair to do so, a clear punitive treatment for running anything on public permissionless blockchains, right? So there was a 1,250% risk weight. And now we're coming back to the real RWAs, the risk-weighted assets that ultimately led, if you hold 8% capital, to 100% capital treatment. And when we say capital, it's really equity. So banks would need to hold 100% capital or equity against all the assets that are issued on a public permissionless blockchain. There were a couple of different buckets, right? So the first bucket and second bucket, stablecoins fell into 1B, I think, where still, even though they were traditional assets, but if they were issued on a public permissionless infrastructure, you would still, as a bank, have to hold 100% capital against it. That seems to change now, because the BCBS chair, Eric Thelen, said in a recent interview that the committee is reconsidering the strict capital rules for banks' crypto exposures because of the framework has become increasingly difficult to apply as the market evolves, obviously, especially given the large growth in stablecoins on public permissionless infrastructure. Yeah, so very, very interesting. The IIF and others in the past, like banking consortiums, have clearly articulated that that should not be implemented as it was proposed. And many nations around the world, including the US, but also UK and Singapore, they've already indicated that they will not implement it in the way that the BCBS has suggested.
Yeah, I think, Manuel, that's super interesting news, because if you have this weight factor of 1,250%, this means, as you said, that banks have to fully back this with equity. So 100%, right? So this also means that anything on a permissionless chain that falls into this categories is just super low incentives for banks to put this on the balance sheet, right? So that's kind of a showstopper, is if this is really the fully full asset, the full equity you have to back it with. So I think it's really important and a really interesting step for the industry that it seems to go away from this, because of course permissionless blockchains do have new risk vectors, maybe even more than other infrastructures. But, you know, we discussed it before, it may not be justified that this was 1,250%, right? So I think that's a very, very important step for the industry. And we will see what reconsidering this means in the end, right? Currently, it's just an announcement, but it can have very massive implications for the industry.
Exactly. And when we look at Germany as a last point, maybe it's quite interesting. The CRR3 has implemented the guidance not in the way that Basel actually guided the national legislators as well. This is an interim state. So this was already introduced in July 9th, 2024. So last year, we haven't covered this yet. I only stumbled across this recently as well. So the current version basically also treats existing financial instruments that are issued on blockchains similar to how these existing instruments are treated, right? So what does that mean? And that includes even stablecoins. What does that mean? In Europe, we have electronic money tokens. This is the regulated form of stablecoins, right? They would be treated similar to existing electronic money, yeah? And tokenized securities would be treated as securities. So there's no technology punitive treatment that is currently in the law. Again, this is only an interim version, but the EBA has now in August this year actually also issued a draft RTS. The RTS is a regulatory technical standard, which is the foundation for the EU Commission, which is expected to propose a final legislation. And even in this RTS, there's no punitive treatment. So it looks as if also Europe will not implement it in the way that Basel recommends it. Yeah, so we'll follow on that. Actually, until January the 1st in Europe, there should be national legislations to be implemented. Let's see how that will now develop, given that also the BCBS is suggesting to look into this again.
Stell dir vor, deine Heizung hält dich nicht nur warm, sondern verdient dir gleichzeitig auch noch Bitcoin. Genau das macht der Ofen 2 von 21 Energy. Das ist keine Zukunftsmusik, das ist österreichische Ingenieurskunst. Der Ofen 2 ist im Grunde eine Bitcoin-Mining-Heizung. Er wandelt 1000 Watt Strom zu 100% in Wärme um, heizt damit Räume bis zu 50 Quadratmetern und während er heizt, nutzt er die Energie doppelt, er schürft Bitcoin für dich. Und das Beste daran: echtes Plug and Play. Du brauchst gar kein technisches Vorwissen. Einfach anstecken, per WLAN mit der 21 Energy App verbinden. Fertig in 3 Minuten. Er ist flüsterleise und sieht richtig top aus. Premium Stahldesign made in Austria. Statt Energie nur zu verbrauchen, bekommst du dein Cashback in Bitcoin. Nutze deine Energie doppelt, hol dir den Ofen 2 auf 21energy.com und spare 5% mit dem Code Was Bitcoin bringt in einem Wort.
So lots of ground now in this shorter market update. Let's maybe continue with the buckets. Let's start maybe with stablecoins, Atakan, right? Before we then jump into tokenized deposits.
Since May, I think there's been lots of news. I will try to focus a bit on more established players moving into the space. So I group the stablecoin news into 3 buckets. Maybe let's start with B2C payments, or payouts. Payments from businesses to individuals. This is particularly interesting for the gig economy. So freelancers or digital creators could now be compensated directly via stablecoins. Specifically relevant for digital workers that are employed in other countries or do not have access to a US dollar bank account. Visa recently announced a pilot that enables businesses to make payouts using US dollar stablecoins. So again, we see the US dollar being used, and they do not specify which stablecoin that would be. What's interesting about this one, so going into this payment is done via fiat rails. So you pay in fiat, but the receiver receives stablecoins. This aims to drastically speed up global payouts. So what used to take days and usually eat up a lot of fees is now being settled in minutes. This is obviously great news for cross-border creators or remote freelancers in underbanked markets and provides them a real shift. They have immediate access, fewer dependencies on FX corridors, and less friction overall. Similarly, competitor MasterCard is also extending its payout network by partnering with Tunes to bring stablecoins to over 120 countries. Again, marketplaces, gig platforms, and freelance networks using MasterCard's infrastructure can now offer stablecoin payouts as a native option. The only difference here, you're going in with stablecoins and also going out with stablecoins. For MasterCard and its partners, this is again a way to modernize payout flows and attracting new business models around payout offerings. Now, why do these news matter? Well, they show that stablecoins are bleeding into everyday payout infrastructure. Once large payment networks such as Visa and MasterCard are embedding token rails, stablecoins become everyday payments. I mean, this could lead to a structural shift in how we move money. If, and this is a big if, but if payouts continuously are stored in wallets and later used to make payments, this might kickstart the broad use of stablecoins also in retail payments, something we haven't seen so far.
I think this is super interesting because, you know, when you think about stablecoin adoption and payments, which we so far really don't see, right? I mean, there's this quite good Artemis study that looks at payments companies that ultimately offer hosted wallets and then really focus on payments use cases. It's like less than 1% of the stablecoin volume is really in payments. And I was always wondering which payments use cases have a high chance to fly, and you're going to come to retail and remittance as well. This is definitely also one that I see. But the payouts, the B2C cases, to me also seem quite interesting because on the recipient side, it's much easier for a retail client to go to a crypto exchange, for example, and then sell the stablecoin for local currency if you need it. But you cannot tell this to a corporate so easily, right? To say, well, if you now receive the stablecoins and go to a crypto exchange to get your local currency, there are some much higher hurdles to do that, right? So you would need some institutional off-ramping in that particular country. But with a retail customer, that might work. And the gig worker in some of these countries might eventually also want to hold US dollars, right? And one interesting piece that you noticed, if I got it right, that Visa doesn't even require the sender, so a corporate, to hold stablecoins, but rather go from traditional bank accounts, whereas MasterCard requires the sender to have a stablecoin. Is that a fair summary?
Correct. Yes, Manuel. Quite interesting indeed. If we then move maybe to, as you said, the retail payments, this is quite a new trend, I would say, that's popping up now in 2025, where stablecoins are being more and more moved into the retail and remittance payments area. There's one particularly interesting news. Western Union actually looked this up. It's a 175-year-old company focusing and specializing on remittances that has over 100 million customers globally and operates in over 200 countries. I actually used Western Union once myself and was frustrated with the fees I had to pay back then. What's new is Western Union is now launching their own stablecoin. It's called USD Payment Token, so short USDPT. People need to get creative nowadays. lots of stablecoins. And it's issued in partnership with Anchorage Digital. So Western Union is also moving to blockchain rails to accelerate their global payment. Interestingly, Western Union has decided to exclusively issue their stablecoin on Solana. While most EMT issuers are focusing on Ethereum and other layer twos, Western Union has selected Solana in contrast to competitor MoneyGram, which are using Stellar for their stablecoin rails. But again, Solana makes a lot of sense. It settles in sub-seconds with finality, has huge throughput and minimal fees. So ideal for cross-border payments.
And this also clearly shows both Western Union, also MasterCard and Visa, they are reinventing themselves, right? Because they see there is a trend going on. And if we are not doing anything, we will struggle and we may be not, be alive another 175 years. So that also shows the urgency and the market movement that they have to reinvent themselves. Otherwise, they have fundamental issues.
And for Visa and MasterCard, it's a good addition to the cross-border push payment networks that they are having, right? So Visa Direct and MasterCard, I think it's called Go, where this is very different to the card rails that usually we are talking about, right? And I mean, in some cases, these networks are used, but when you look at the revenue, I don't have the concrete numbers, but clearly it plays a minor role for them, right? But clearly they want to grow their business in this area as well. So it's a good addition to the existing rails that they're using on these networks to now also use this new form of money.
Definitely. I think there's a lot of efficiency that can be gained. I mean, global remittances amount to nearly $1 trillion every year. And if fees are around 5%, I mean, just do the math. It's massive, massive potential to save dollars and make more efficient payments. Cool. Let's move from a very old company to maybe a younger company. Klarna, the Swedish fintech known for the buy now, pay later solution, is also launching their stablecoin. So it's called Klarna USD, again, a US dollar-backed stablecoin. And with their launch, Klarna becomes actually the first bank to launch on Tempo. That is still not live. It's on testnet, but it's the payment-focused blockchain backed by Stripe and Paradigm. With over 100 million customers, the aim here is clear. I mean, Klarna is trying to embed stablecoins into e-commerce and payment flows to enable merchants and customers to transact without traditional banking rails. Again, we just discussed Visa and MasterCard. Potentially, there's also the goal here to cut out those middlemen. Speed seems to be amongst the most relevant drivers here. I mean, according to Reuters, Klarna said that customers could eventually hold and pay merchants with Klarna USD bypassing, and now emphasis, slow bank transfers. This also gives new business models to Klarna. I mean, if successful, customers could get cash back or rewards in Klarna USD, which in turn could incentivize users to make payments using Klarna USD. So quite interesting here as well.
But what I don't understand is really why everybody issues a new stablecoin. We do have so many new stablecoins. I understand that the business model is very promising in the US, right? With having government bonds very highly remunerated. But why not using, do we need now this 100 new stablecoins coming up that are issued by all the major players? Or isn't this just adding complexity?
Definitely fragmentation, yeah.
Exactly. I have a strong opinion on this. I don't think so. I think it's going to be a few players that will end up making the race. But it's a hype topic at the moment, Jonas. So as I said, people need to get creative.
But clearly everyone sees the tremendous earnings, especially of Tether, right? We have not touched that, given that we are already quite on time, but it's gigantic what they earn, right? So the issuance of a stablecoin is quite profitable. And I think this is what everybody is about, is chasing, right?
Yeah, but I think it's not going to be about issuing in the future, because everyone and SBC can issue a token or a stablecoin, but it's rather creating the ecosystem and also having value-added services on top of the stablecoin that will make the race. But maybe last sentence to Klarna. I think what's really interesting is that this could be the first touch point for merchants to come into contact with stablecoins and essentially potentially bring stablecoins also to the masses if successful. And maybe question to you guys. So next year when there's the Black Friday sales going on everywhere, we're paying with stablecoins?
I mean, it will be offered, right? There are a couple of acquirers that already work on offering it. Stripe is already also implementing it with Bridge, right? So I think that will continue to pop up. Will it be used? That's the question. But I mean, payments is usually a network effect with like slow ramp ups. The same problem as Vero, the same problem will also the digital euro have. So maybe it will still take time, but it's here to stay, I think, right?
And if I learned something in the past, that I'm over optimistic when it comes to time. So concretely to your question, Atakan, I don't think so. This will be next year, but this will come. And you know what I really hope, that in the future, after we have, we are through this hype of everybody issues a stablecoin, we will not even see that it's a stablecoin, right? So I would like to have the user experience, you pay smooth, like with the internet, you use it today, right? Most people don't know how the protocols in the background work, right? We just use it because it's easy and it works. And I really hope that we also do see this in payments, so that it actually, in a few years of now, we just use a cheap, convenient, quick payment method, and whatever is in the back, it should be the best solution.
Good, then let's move to the next one. While stablecoin payments might be easy or easier in e-commerce. I think in-store payments with stablecoins remain to be a challenge, specifically in Europe. I mean, if you look at Asia, there's it's quite widely distributed to make QR code payments. Think of WeChat Pay or Alipay. But it's quite a rarity in the Western world. However, there's one exception. It's Switzerland-based Twint. Twint, look this up as well. Twint is adopted with over 75% of the population using Twint in online payments or in-store payments. And Twint is completely QR code-based, so quite interesting for stablecoins. Twint is now exploring the integration of a Swiss franc stablecoin as well as the Swiss EID. Now, this could turn Twint into a fully-fledged stablecoin wallet as well as a payments app. And the motivations are similar to Western Union and Klarna, so I won't repeat. But quite interesting that Twint, as a QR code-based payment provider, is also looking into stablecoins here as well.
Yeah, now we are missing the experts from Switzerland, Alex and Michi, in the podcast, because both have been working with Pascal Bruderer on the Swiss Stablecoin AG, right? I actually don't know whether that's the same project. I tried to look it up now, but it seems that it is not the same, or rather a separate initiative. Let's definitely come back to that one, I would say, huh? Quite interesting.
Then closing the retailer remittances news, maybe. My TLDR will be quite short. What we can clearly see in these trends is that stablecoins are moving away from the crypto trading centric use cases, and they're actually being deployed to real alternatives for remittances, retail payments, and specifically cross-border payments. So the next gen payment infrastructure is being built now, and everybody seems to be wanting to have a piece of that.
That's the truth. Yeah.
Cool. Let's move to the third bucket that I brought with me. It's about regulatory and financial stability topics regarding stablecoins. We've seen MiCA and the Genius Act already giving a regulatory framework to stablecoins in Europe and the US. And now the UK is following up. So the Bank of England published a consultation on systemic stablecoins. And there's quite some interesting takes here. One is stablecoin issuers must back their tokens with safe assets. And the Bank of England is requiring stablecoin holders to back at least 40% of their reserves in unremunerated deposits at the central bank itself, so central bank reserves. This is quite interesting. They initially had the idea that 100% of central bank reserves would be the backing of stablecoins. Now they're dropping it to 40%. This is still a novelty. If you look at Europe and MiCA, for instance, there's 0% of central bank reserves on stablecoins. Additionally, they mentioned that for a transitional measure, new issuers could hold up to 95% in government debt. Again, huge difference to MiCA, where smaller issuers have to hold up at least 30% in cash deposits. One novelty is our holding limits. So quite interestingly, the Bank of England is proposing holding limits for individuals and businesses. Individuals would be allowed to hold up to £20,000, and businesses would be allowed to hold up to £10 million, with potential exemptions if there's legitimate reasons, but quite an interesting take. I mean, it leaves me wondering how they would control holding limits in stablecoins if we move on a public permissionless infrastructure. I don't see any other way than having whitelisted wallets that are also KYC'd to ensure that one particular person is not having two wallets with then a sum of more than £20,000.
And the intermediaries providing those wallets would likely need to do that, I reckon, right? But it's certainly an interesting discussion that was also quite strongly discussed in the, at least, crypto industry, why that would be. I mean, I think it's all around disintermediation of the banking system, right? But also that would blow up quite significantly the balance sheet of the central bank if now new demand side for central bank money comes in, right? That's quite interesting. As long as the funds are not recycled from banks into the central bank. Quite novel approach, as you say, also with the non-remunerated part. It used to be 100%, which would have made the business case a complete, non-working business case. Now with 40% is better, but still a bit strange. Yeah.
Good. Then looking at time, maybe we can move to the
next we've
section.
Progressed quite strongly already. I'll speed it up a bit on tokenized deposits, but there have been quite some news that JP Morgan has done. And the update was all circling around the Singapore FinTech Festival, where they announced the go-live of the JPMD, which now has a couple of different names, at least I see it that way. They called it US Dollar Deposit Token, JPMD in the past. Now even JP Morgan Coin is back. I heard that in a couple of promotional videos as well from the conference. So what is it? It's basically a deposit that JP Morgan issues on Base. We've been talking about it as it was announced and tested already, but now it's basically live. So JP Morgan now not only has Kinexys, which is their private permissioned infrastructure, which you could rather think of like a core banking system, right? It's behind the walls of JP Morgan. But now they also issue their deposits on Base, which is a public permissioned infrastructure from Coinbase, the layer two. They call this also deposit token. I was a bit puzzled and a bit frustrated with it, to be honest, because they brought up this very good distinction and delineation between tokenized deposits and deposit tokens, saying a deposit token is really this bearer-like asset that can also be held by other clients than only JP Morgan clients. Now, this is not the case. So this token that they now issue on Base is also only for JP Morgan clients. In the Bloomberg article, they also clearly stated that this is their aim to go in the long term also, that clients of other clients can hold the deposit on Base. But at the moment, it's really JP Morgan customers that can hold deposits on the Base infrastructure. And think of it that they now extend the reach of the deposits also in external networks. So I don't want to understate that this is a significant development in the market, right? Because now a bank really issues a deposit on an external ledger. We have not seen this in the past. So congratulations on this move. I think it's also a big legal question how to do that. But very, very, very interesting. Again, but only for clients of JP Morgan at the moment. And what other competitors do? I mean, we still see lots of deployment and adoption on bank-centric ledgers, right? So Citi, Bank of America, Standard Chartered, UBS, HSBC, they also now have these bank-centric blockchains. But so far, no other bank has issued on an external network like a public permission network such as Base. Yeah, then other news, what we've also seen, and this goes hand in hand with this announcement, is that JP Morgan, via this JPMD token on Base, now also allows swapping into USDC. And this basically bridges the closed bank tokens that only JP Morgan clients can hold into a permissionless token that basically anyone on Base can hold, which is USDC. Yeah. And this is quite interesting because you can also interpret it as an on and off ramp into USDC, right? So you as a JP Morgan client, you can use your deposit if you are a JP Morgan client on Base. But if you want to send funds to a non-JP Morgan client, you can then swap the deposit token or the tokenized deposit, however you now want to call it, the JP Morgan coin into USDC and then send it to anyone on Base. So it's also quite significant, I would say, because it really bridges the restricted permissioned money into a permissionless money. And JP Morgan now supports that.
And I mean, that's important because we discussed this before, Manuel, that was often like the key disadvantage, right? On permissioned tokenized deposits that you cannot send this to clients outside your organization. So I agree. I think that's really a really interesting move. And all this news shows that JP Morgan is really serious about tokenized deposits, right?
Yeah. And tokenized deposit platforms that are multi-bank, such as Agora or Partio or even the Swift Ledger might think about that, needs the settlement asset in order to settle between tokenized deposits of different banks, right? And here, you could even argue as well that USDC might become a settlement asset if there were other tokenized deposits on Base, right? This doesn't exist yet. But given that USDC can be held by anyone, you could also think about USDC acting as a settlement asset for all those that cannot hold the tokenized deposit of JP Morgan on Base. Yeah. Switching to Kinexys, again, which is the closed blockchain platform, which you can think rather as a core banking system from my perspective of JP Morgan. They've also had two interesting news there. Alibaba also now uses the BDA balances, so the blockchain deposit account balances, which they now call it on Kinexys, right, to go for 24/7 cross-border payments. Interestingly enough, clearly also only for those that are connected to Kinexys and actually are JP Morgan clients. So I haven't seen whether this is only internal flows. I think Ant Financial already does that to a significant part that has been announced in the past, but now also Alibaba wants to do that. And another news that came in is that JP Morgan are working with DBS on a framework also for interbank tokenized deposit transfers. I haven't seen lots of information, at least publicly, how they want to do this, because again, similar to what I've said a couple of minutes ago, you would need to have some sort of settlement asset in order to settle between the different tokenized deposits. And now we're talking different private bank-centric blockchain infrastructures to settle between those two, right? And they want to work on that, right? So to work on an operation and legal standardization, a cross-bank framework that shall allow the settlement between those two platforms and the two different tokenized deposits. So we're going to follow that closely, how that will look like, if it will look differently to what we see in the market with these platforms like Agora and so forth. And last but not least, also Citi has now announced that they want to work with Coinbase on, first of all, also stablecoin integration, but also their Citi token service has received an update that they now also are live with euros on their Citi token service. And this is their private permissioned infrastructure, right? So two complementary strategies. First of all, for allowing efficient on and off ramp access into public stablecoins via Coinbase, but then also its own token service expansion into euros. So two strategies, one the closed and one the open loop, the closed rail and open rail strategy. And Citi, I found quite active in the past weeks and months on both sides, right? Again, on the tokenized deposit side, but also on the stablecoin side. Yeah. So quite a vibrant ecosystem on both sides, stablecoins, but also tokenized deposits. Private forms of money only on blockchains, but there were there were also significant news on the public side. Jonas, handing over to you on some updates on the digital euro.
Indeed. Let's go into the digital euro. So there was two key news. One was that the European Parliament published their draft report on the digital euro. So some background on that. We know that in June 2023, the European Commission published the legislative draft on the digital euro. And now a few weeks ago, the European Parliament basically commented on this one. We list this report in the show notes. So this means we had to wait now for 2.5 years until this report. But now it's finally here. What's now about to happen is that the European Parliament aims to have a unified perspective on the digital euro by end of May 2026. So there's a draft report. There will be discussions ongoing, amendments whatsoever. And in the end, mid of 2026, there will be a opinion by the Parliament, which then goes into the negotiations of the legal draft. Right. So that's the normal process in the EU. This takes time, but you know we see progress here. And of course, the key question is, what does the Parliament draft report now say on the digital euro? And it says a lot. So it's 160 pages. So again, if you want to read it in full, we list it in the show notes. And here, in the next few minutes, we will just focus on the most relevant aspects. And I think to quote the key narrative of the whole report, and that's very important, that's a direct quote. They say the digital euro should be assessed against clearly defined problems and compared with the best available market alternatives. Existing European retail private payment initiatives in a significant number of member states are widely adopted in their national markets and satisfy a large part of the customer needs. So in short, the digital euro needs to provide concrete USPs and should only be issued, at least the online one, talk about this in a second, if there are USPs and if private solutions cannot really address this need. And that's, I think, a very clear and a very bold statement. And that has, of course, a few implications. Implication one is the suggested focus of this parliament draft reports is on the offline digital euro. So they say the offline digital euro would already address a lot of the key goals that the euro system has with the CBDC, like reduce over-reliance on non-European players, provide a high level of privacy, does not imply a high financial stability risks. So they suggest concretely to establish the digital euro initially only in the offline digital euro or with priority on the offline digital euro form, if you will. And importantly, the online digital euro, again in quote, should be contingent on the absence of a pan-European sovereign retail payment solution covering person-to-person, person of interaction, and e-commerce use case in the euro area. So this means the online digital euro should only be issued if the private sector cannot really address the value propositions here. And concretely, the parliament asks the commission to assess this. So to assess the question, are here private sector solutions that address this, or is the online digital euro needed, right? And that's, I think, a very interesting and a very bold statement from the European Parliament in this draft report.
And you can clearly see that there are private initiatives emerging, right? So Vero is growing by the day and by the week. You see lots of press releases that they will also now go live in the e-commerce. And I think you can clearly have an argument that, the private sector is now really trying to deliver something. If the digital euro comes, what will happen with those private initiatives, right? Will they be completely driven out of the market? Why do you actually need a public solution for that if the market is developing it? The key question is now, is the market, the private sector, actually developing a solution? And that, I think, is at the heart, right? That they should be given more time to provide a solution and then evaluate it. I think 24 months after the offline digital euro will go online, it should be evaluated whether or not there's enough coverage in pan-Europe on a pan-European basis that ultimately justifies the issuance of the online version of the digital euro.
Yeah, and I mean, the key question is really, can the private sector provide such a solution, right? And we do have next week from the Digital Euro Association an event in the European Parliament where we want to exactly discuss that and also to maybe tease. We have a podcast next week with Alexandra Hachmeister from Bundesbank where we exactly ask her the question as well, what she thinks about this. Don't want to spoil this, but, she sees definitely a public and private sector collaboration when it comes to these to also the digital euro and also together with Vero, but more in the episode next week. And besides two other core aspects of this draft report, one was really that it was called out for a higher priority on wholesale CBDC. So that this should given more attention because also the USP is basically more straightforward. And there was also mentioned that more power should be given to the European Commission compared to the euro system. So again, when it's about setting limits, the draft report suggests that the Commission is setting the limits in a process and not the ECB, right? So it's a little bit of this power discussions that are, kind of expected showing muscle. But I guess that's kind of the key factor. So it's really about online and offline. And this will probably be a question that we will stick to for quite a while. And also, I'm curious to see if this will stay in this draft report or if there is now, lobbying and argumentation work going on that in the end, the final report of the parliament maybe goes into a different direction. But the anchor is set. So let's see how this develops.
Yeah, and two additional thoughts on that. So when I read the proposal of Fernando Navarrete, what stemmed out for me was also this completely new way how he thinks about offline payments, right? And honestly, I'm still completely puzzled how that can be called even offline, because the version that he sees as offline looks to me as rather an off-bank solution, but still online, right? Because he also wants to allow not only physical proximity payments, where two devices are held next to each other, but also, I think he calls it far distance payments, that ultimately requires internet connectivity, right? Because you cannot have any non-internet connectivity that is offline, like Bluetooth, that goes for hundreds of kilometers, right? At least I'm not aware of any technology beyond the internet that allows that. It sounds to me really like a new way that he proposes, which technically I don't understand, that without an intermediary, you can transfer funds that are stored on a device to another device. That sounds a lot to me like what blockchain has solved, right? But here it's not only stored on one physical device, the tokens in your wallet, but rather on all the different nodes, right? So it's a distributed ledger, which he doesn't foresee. He foresees that balance is stored on physical devices that can then, without an intermediary, be transferred, I suppose, via the internet, which is clearly an online version, yeah? So I think the industry is really puzzled. I listened also to the discussions in the parliaments, where many parliamentarians have also raised that question. How is this technically even possible? The ECB was puzzled as well. I am still as well. So that was one piece. But I'll pause here if you have any views on that, if you also stumbled across that.
I read that and for me it was exactly the same.
I mean, first thought that came up to my mind was actually in Ecuador, they used this. Also, there was a CBDC pilot quite early and they used mobile networks to send payments. So that was the first thought. But then looking into it a bit more, it seems like this is a completely new thing. So quite interested to see how they're going to solve that problem.
But that's actually an interesting thought that you have, yeah? Because also M-Pesa in African countries started, I think, with mobile payments, right? Maybe he thinks in this direction. It's a good point. And the second point that I quickly wanted to raise is, when reading through his proposal, what stemmed out as well is that he very, very, very diligently separates the online and the offline balance and the online and the offline wallet, right? And this is also what puzzles me a bit. This is actually true also for the design of the digital euro that the ECB foresees, that they plan to issue two different wallets, right? Yeah, a colleague of mine has brought this up to my attention. I'm very thankful for that. I have not thought about it in the past, but to me also from a user experience, this really makes little sense, right? To have two different balances, one online balance and one offline balance, that needs to be explained to the European citizens, that you now have an online balance that you can pre-fund, which you actually don't need because you can directly from your bank account, but then also the offline balance. And he starts now by saying the offline balance should be coming first and then eventually also the online balance with an online scheme. My take is, why not combine online and offline balances and basically have one balance that can be sent offline, yeah, but not like he maybe foresees it, but rather offline, and then eventually also use the same balance in a potential online scheme when it comes, yeah?
I think this is the security trade-off. The ECB argued that there might be different holding limits for offline and online payments or holdings. And I believe this is that exact discussion, Manuel. If you look into the digital euro development, it's a highly complex discussion, and I'm very excited how they're going to solve it. Just ramping up the limits to the online limits then actually leads to a security issue, because if you can hold more than, I don't know, let's take the very well-known 3,000 euro mark, if you can hold up to 3,000 euros in your offline wallet, and those euros are then duplicated and then distributed around, it just provides a security issue for the ECB. So very interesting to see.
So we'll definitely follow the digital euro closely over the next months, because now I think it's the last sprint before the legislation is finalized next year. Looking at the time, I suggest we round it up and go into the last piece, which is our Knowledge Byte section. Jonas, what did you bring?
So I brought some piece again on the digital euro, which is just, if you heard what the parliament is doing, if you're interested now what the ECB is doing in the next phase. They went to the next phase of the digital euro project. You can read it up there. It's a lot about technical readiness, market engagement, and legislative process support. So if you want to read more, check out this knowledge byte from my side.
Nice. I brought an interesting report from Block Stories. They call it the European Banks and Stablecoin Report. And it's an honest snapshot of how European banks are approaching stablecoins, what drives their strategies, and also where they diverge. They interviewed Circle as a stablecoin issuer, ING, BBVA, Oddo BHF, which also has its own stablecoin issued out of their own balance sheet now, Raiffeisen, DZ Bank, and SocGen. And there is also a case study on how Sockgen Forge leverages Morpho, this decentralized lending platform, to drive demand for its stablecoin. So quite an interesting report, and kudos to the colleagues from Block Stories.
Yes, and my knowledge byte, sticking to the theme of stablecoins, is also stablecoin related. It's actually a paper by Ulrich Binzeil, a former guest of yours. He wrote a paper called Regulatory Responses to the Financial Stability Implications of Stablecoins. And he compares regulatory approaches across some jurisdictions. Interestingly, he notes that all authorities agree that stablecoins cannot be remunerated due to deposit flight risks. But he argues that prohibiting the remuneration of stablecoins is not necessarily fostering financial stability, and also suggests three regulatory options on that. So quite interesting to read.
I actually also read that, and I was fascinated because he also opened up the possibility to hold reserves at the central bank as a backing asset for stablecoins, and makes a compelling case out of it. Very, very interesting read, definitely. And interesting to read from him after he left the ECB, right?
Definitely. I think it then solves the digital euro issue as well. We would then have a synthetic CBDC with the stablecoins, no?
Cool. Guys, looking at the time, let's wrap up. Dear listeners, thanks a lot for following again. Lots have happened. We hope to have given you a snapshot of what has happened over the last 30 days. Again, really much focusing on digital fiat money today. If you liked it, let your colleagues and friends know about the podcast. We're always so eager, always eager to continue our reach globally now that we are talking in English since this year. Almost 1 year has passed already in English. So yeah, nothing to add. Thanks a lot for tuning in, Jonas and Atakan, and talk to you soon.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.